Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Troy McGinnis, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Greetings, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm this evening's host, Jay Hursko, and joined with me is board member Chris Merman. Say hello, Merman.
Yeehaw, Agilists.
So the topic of tonight's conversation is the Agile Dojo, the Agile Team Dojo, the Agile Coaching Dojo, the Dojo, right? We're all hearing this word and this term come up more and more, and a lot of us, admittedly so, are not familiar with it, so Merman and I were going back and forth, figured we wanted to go down this path, and what better way to discuss this than to find ourselves an actual Agile Dojo coach, which is what we did, and joining us is Andrew Deal, goes by Drew. Drew, thank you for joining us.
I'm very excited about it.
And we are happy to have you. So to give everybody a little bit of backstory, and I guess to start the episode off, showing how much, I guess, naivete that both Chris and I have, we came up with a first pass agenda that we sent to Drew to have him look over, to go over some feedback. And Drew came back with a laundry list of bullets of things that we weren't even considering.
Are you sure you want to talk about the right thing? Because I don't think we're talking about
Right. So yeah. This may be one of our more intellectual conversations, educational, because I don't have much of a background. And I don't think Chris does either. So before we dive into that, Drew, let's give you a chance to set the stage. You want to give us a little bit of background about yourself, your experiences, how this conversation came about, what makes you the dojo guy?
Okay. Well, there's some interesting background there. I don't think there's any one way to be a dojo guy per se. My background is a little unique as well in that I didn't come from the corporate world. I have my own business for 15, 17 years, something like that. I kind of blurs toward the end where I just had my own setup. I was dealing with entrepreneurs directly, and we were very agile in a very free sense. We were small enough to be nimble about everything and stay in constant communication, get user feedback. So that's kind of my whole basis for, you know, thinking about the business of software development. So in having come to Verizon and a few other places and doing Agile, the Dojo was a great deal for me because it was like bringing them in at a very intimate level and getting them, you know, them to feel like they're almost having personal training, if, for lack of a better analogy, to feel like what it's like to maximize the team environment, to exercise every muscle that need to be exercised to get their shit done. And it's just a great experience all around.
So how did you get introduced to where did the term dojo first come about in your, like, from your experience? Like, where did it originate from?
Yeah, luckily I was Verizon was in a place where I was kind of seeing something shut down, some kind of opportunities go away, and we hired a guy named Ross Clanton in Verizon, who was the target dojo guy who set up that transformation there. And when he came to Verizon, he wanted to start dojos, and I was happy to join into that whole deal. I first heard about the whole dojo experience of 6 weeks and the 2.5 day sprints at one of our internal DevOps days. And from that, I was like all in. I was like, first of all, I got to investigate this thing. I got to see how it would work. And I was really connecting with the idea that you can take shorter iterations and really get the feedback cycle moving.
Drew, did it start at Target? Is Target the first company to really pick up this and run with it? Or are they just the first one to make a name for themselves by doing it? Like, were they the original originators?
It started a little bit before that, but Target was the first, I think, big corporate place to really attach its brand to it and to really, you know, make it somewhere people can go and learn more. The Dev Jam company, David Hussman, and that whole company of Agilists were the ones that got that whole track going.
Okay. And the word dojo, much like Shuhari inside of Agile, comes from, I think it is Aikido, and it literally means place of the way. So you learned your place of the way. You just said you learned it at Verizon, some of the guys who actually started it up at Target. So, and I think you briefly touched on this. So what is the underlying motivator for taking a team through this type of exercise? Like what is the whole concept behind the idea of a dojo and how do we, you know, what would cause a company or cause a group or an organization to say, this is something we need to adopt?
Right, right. That's a really good way to put it, because the term is appealing. The idea of having a place where you can have intensive coaching is appealing to a lot of organizations. It's real natural for companies to see that it may be a fit for them when they have particularly hard issues to deal with. But at the core of it, like the place of the way, another way to put it is in the martial arts sense is how a place where people come to master their skills. So it really has to do with an idea of mastering your skills as an individual and as a team. So where that kind of plays back, or where that, you know, rebounds back to a company is like, do I really believe in, you know, making our organization or a subset of our organization a learning group or a learning organization that would adopt this kind of approach? Is if all you want to do is fix things or enforce compliance in a more effective way, it wouldn't be as good of a fit for you versus a company that's saying, we really want to transform into a learning organization.
So if I'm going to put it in Agilese, right, it really comes from companies that aren't just looking to adopt, but to also transform, right? It's not a, it's not a company that wants to, and I'll throw out a common example for most of the people who listen. It's not a company who wants to absorb enough safe that it fits for purpose, and then they move on. It truly is for companies that want to cross the chasm and really transform into some type of impressive growth, like maturation, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I should say absolutely, but it's also a little more nuanced, because there's nothing wrong with not knowing how deep you want to go down the rabbit hole to try it out, as long as you're willing to take the first steps. So where a company might trip itself up is if they've already trying to roadmap the future of what a dojo should look like in advance. If they think they can map it out in advance and have a study group around what it should be, they might falter. But if they're willing to say, we want to try something new and like dabble into the learning organization style or that kind of trust, then they should definitely go for it.
So Drew, I want to touch on the learning org piece of this. So I'm going to make a few logic leaps, so forgive me if I leaped incorrectly. But so the idea of dojos, it took a while, or it was difficult to kind of take root hold in large organizations, right? So coming from, you know, Target and the places you've had experience with before, you also want to instill this idea of a learning, like an organization that wants to learn. So I guess, in my head, I immediately thought, well, do these large organizations really truly want to learn? Is that the case, or is it more learning is just difficult in these large organizations?
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I've been looking at that recently. It, like for an alpha organization that has a, like it's hard for them to shake a top-down approach to things, execution and learning can kind of be oil and water. So it feels like an either or to a lot of companies. And you maybe those listening to the podcast may not want to really dissect whether they're one or the other, or whether it really is oil and water, but there's going to come a time when you have a team that comes to a dojo and you're going to say, we're going to carve out time for learning. We're going to make learning the primary goal. You know, it's going to take a little bit of, you know, adjustment and trust for a company to say, okay, let's roll the dice on that. But it's really not an either or, but it feels like it to a lot of the ways companies think about their work. Like for example, let me just put it this way. Like typically, learning is training. People say they think of learning as an investment in sending people away from their work, right? You send them away from their work and they learn and they come back and they do. But a dojo is like learning while you do. So you have to be willing to mix the two and not get hung up over what the breakdown is exactly.
See where my, I like that you said that, but my mind also immediately went to the fact that most of the organizations where I coach, they, if they need a specific type of skill or a type of capability, they'll just go to a third party vendor and they say, get me developers with that skill. Rather than teach or train up, they just say, get me 100 folks that do that. Does that resonate with you at all?
Oh yeah. There's a big deal with, I think about the Reinventing Organizations book that I've been reading about how, you know, companies are trained by experience and by the manufacturing mindset to think that economies of scale is has to be like the means to an end. So I'd rather have, you know, 10 more, if I can mass produce more bodies, that's, you know, a better economy than investing in the mastery of my own core people. So even though we know the latter is true, I think there's something in organizational DNA that makes that less of a consideration.
It's so crazy because, you know, I hear like the organization that I'm coaching at right now, they talk about how they have a lack of subject matter experts, right? People that understand the system and how they work and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, they're onboarding all these new, you know, contract developers kind of a thing. And at the same time, they're just like, man, we don't have enough SMEs. We don't have enough expertise in this areas. Which tells me like, wow, you all are struggling with people that learn and know things, and yet you're not investing time in your people to learn and know things. Right.
Hmm. I've never run into that mix. It's usually I'm usually top heavy on SMEs in my background, but that lack of doers, like one of the dojos we ran had, all these SMEs that hadn't coded in 10 years, and we got them back into coding, and they were like super excited about it.
Oh my God.
That's actually a little bit terrifying. So I want to take a quick aside, because I think we're going down the path of talking about, you know, learning organizations. And I like Drew's line of learning while you do. But maybe let's back it up conceptually, Drew. Can you talk us through how is a dojo set up? What you mentioned 2.5 day sprints, which may have caught some people's ears. So say Chris and I are on a team and we're coming into one of your dojos and you're facilitating it. How is that set up? What does the day over day look like? So what should someone expect if they hear that, hey, your Agile team is next up in the dojo rotation?
Yeah. That's perfect. You say, well, people need to get an idea of the context of it. So, I guess it kind of all starts from giving people space. So first of all, one of the things that really opens the door for the dojo to work is having a team that's not cluttered up with a bunch of other stuff. I mean, which is true in any situation, right? You need that. You need some margin and ability to shut out other things. So what we tell people in the initial consultation is that you need to, you know, think about the dojo as an opportunity to get away from your normal routine. You get out of your normal workspace, you come physically. So a standard dojo at Verizon, for example, was a very much co-located centric situation. We had 7,000 square feet set aside for the dojo to accommodate 6+ teams. well, six was kind of max, I would say, to come in and take 6 weeks out of the normal schedule, bring a backlog of things, particularly sticky wickets or a good thing to bring in that you really need to focus on. Like cloud migration was a really great one because that's one of those, one of many kinds of things where you're going to get around to it someday, but you need a lot of ability to focus to get it done. So we would look for that kind of work for a team to be interested in doing. Call them into the consultation, make sure they had leadership support, make sure they had the margin in their time, make sure they had a rough idea of who was going to be there, not necessarily fully blown out or fully figured out. And then at the next point, we do a charter. So the charters, to me, were one of the most exciting things to do because you're not just scripting what they're going to do. You're actually just inviting them in to really imagine what they could do. So that framing it that way and allowing them to narrow down from this broad, disparate understanding of what was really going to happen into like a clear set of goals and measures was eye-opening. Just being trained in charters and really – that was one of the most areas of prescriptive knowledge for a coach to learn, was how to charter well. So I really took that on. I really loved that whole approach and getting it wrong and learning how to make room for the team to talk and kind of learning how to be a coach almost through that.
That's awesome. Not to cut you off, Drew, I never would have thought that you had to write a charter going in. But now that I look back, one of the cooler interviews I got to do was with Karen Martin, who wrote the book on value stream mapping. And her whole premise is you start with a value stream mapping charter. Mm-hmm. And it talks about what you're going to do, what you're not going to do. And that was eye-opening to me. But now that I hear you talk your way through it, that does make perfect sense. You basically define, I'm assuming, that bounding box, right? Here's what we're setting out to do. Here's what we're really looking to come away with. And here's the construct that we're going to do it in, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
A lot of times when teams get work, they know the what and the how. They know the what and figure out the how, but they don't know the who and the why. And so the charter kind of allows teams to get exposed to things that a lot of times reserved just for the product owners and management. So they get kind of brought in to really own the bigger picture.
So when I think of a charter, right. I can't be the only one in our audience that's doing this, but I think of the old school project charters that we used to do in our waterfall days, kind of a thing. And when I think of charters in more of an agile sense, I think of like the whole team doing like a working agreement. So for maybe those that might be missing a bit of the context behind this whole charter that you're referring to, like, can you maybe lay out some examples or what specific things are we chartering as a dev group?
Yeah. That's a great, and I have luxury of not having had to deal with the older other versions of chartering. So, I'm kind of fresh and singular and
as Mermin is sitting there off screen having flashbacks and shaking.
I just took 7 shots of Jameson.
All right, so a quick outline of our charters. We're basically 4-hour meeting. We tell them to schedule up to 4 hours, get all the people in the room that we think are going to be on the team, including some stakeholders. Part one is intros. Part two is the team name and the team elevator pitch. You know, what is it we're after? And as we're doing the charter, we're thinking in terms of going from this broad understanding that may or may not exist among the members into narrowing it down. So you get how can we agree in the broad picture of things? And then we narrow it down as we go. So that's kind of the mindset that I've adapted more and more going in. And then from that elevator pitch is kind of the broadest sense. And we go from goals and measures. Now we're basically just going through maybe half, almost 2 hours at a time could be caught up in the goals. What are our goals? And then we make the measures juxtaposed to each goal to make sure there's like acceptance criteria. But we don't use Scrum terms in that sense. We just want the team to kind of relax and enjoy talking about what would it mean to reach that goal. So they put those down. And we're putting them on big, you know, stickies or some kind of a visual thing or something, some kind of poster board, a whiteboard deal. And, just kind of getting more used to that. So from that on, we do a couple of quick things like the community map. which is a nice little way of saying who's in what group. Helps team members to know who's a builder, who's a buyer, who's a banker. Just kind of that three-part deal. And that actually, in a way, that's a small part, but it's also a big part for a lot of team members don't have any sense of thinking about design or product thinking that we're building for the customer, building for the user. So who in our team is a buyer? Who in the team would actually use this thing? So, nobody's on the team that's going to use this thing. Let's maybe we should readjust who's going to be on the team. So we start to get into some of the cross-functionality planning, even in the midst of the charter. So they get involved in who they'd want to have on the team to cover all the bases there, have a stakeholder in the team as well. So then we go on, at this point, we go into a learning or skills matrix where we see who knows what on the team and who can teach. So this is one of the part that really resonates is we're there to learn. That the idea of a dojo is you're there to learn, but the coaches aren't going to be the only teachers. Your teammates are going to be teachers too. So by putting that matrix together, the different skills we need for the project, who knows it, who wants to learn it, we kind of map out a lot of our stories. A lot of our learning stories are going to be built off of based on that that learning matrix. So that's. That all leads up at the end of the charter. The last hour or so is going to be the working agreement. So that's where it's
right.
A lot of other ones. So you get into like, what do we care about? What are we going to do? When are we going to show up? And the only thing that the dojo prescribes is that you have at least 6 hours a day to be there together as a team, that people agree to be there physically. You have like an agreed upon lunch break. So it's literally like, we're on, you know, we're not just randomly kind of around in the same room. We're literally around the same table, 6 hours a minimum a day. So that's the only thing that we expect from them in terms of what we prescribe, and the rest is all up to them.
And how long does it typically go for, Drew? Is it a 2 week thing? Like a typical iteration, like a scrum sprint? Is it longer than that? Is it really depend?
It's usually 6 weeks.
Oh, okay.
6 weeks is kind of set up based on the idea that it takes 6 weeks to learn new habits. And that seems to have worked well. It's about the maximum people can stand.
Right. You're saying they get tired of you quickly, Drew, is what I hear you.
No, they get tired of each other. They never get tired of us. So you can cry and sob when it's time to say goodbye.
So we have people at a lot of different levels listen to this podcast, Drew. And so as I was hearing you describe this, this kind of working agreement and chartering kind of session that you're going in, I want to kind of give you this opportunity to kind of reach out to these leaders, because some of them could be listening to this going, oh my goodness, they're deciding all of this without any business folks or any project managers or scrum masters in the room. Like, Why are the developers deciding all these things on their own, kind of a thing? Like, what, you know, how does all of these conversations help empower a development group?
Well, when you think, I mean, in terms of what attracts people to do it, I mean, in my experience, the developer teams themselves rarely, there's some times where they come out and they found that we're there. We've marketed internally at Verizon and other places, and they would come. But more often than not, it's usually a development manager of some kind who needed more bodies but couldn't get them any other way except to join us.
Right.
We would overcome this misunderstanding quite often that, no, we're not extra bodies on your team. we're not going to do the work for them, you know. Don't.
Yeah.
But that, you know, so that would be a way to come in. But it would be very, very quick for them to realize just having the focus alone would enable them to get more done. So it kind of connected that. I don't know if it's exactly what you asked, but there would oftentimes be this thing like, we were told if we come to the dojo, we'll get the job done. We'll get twice as much done half the time or something like that. You know, we tell them, no, just like anything else, you got to slow down to speed up. You got to maybe come in the dojo with 3 weeks worth of work and we'll do it in 6 weeks, but then you'll be turbo charged there, you know, blah, 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 superlative extra coolness after that.
Yeah. I think you kind of made the point. I think the thing that I always try to, I guess when I'm coaching organizations, the point of why I keep focusing on learning and this need to just give motivated individuals the room to kind of work and grow kind of a thing is so often these large organizations, they feel the need to drive things like as if success or excellence or quality is something that can be driven kind of a thing. Yeah. Right. And to your, I kind of jokingly referred to like, why don't business folks want to come to this thing? And you were even like, look, well, we invite them, right? They're totally invited to come stick around, but they're too busy going to their status meetings or their, you know, or their whatevers, right? Mm-hmm. The challenge in creating a true learning organization, challenge in creating an empowered set of engineering folks to get work done is really truly just give them that room and that space quit putting your thumb on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's one of the things I've said to people is that people don't need to be, you know, they don't need to be X, Y, and Z verbed into being a better team. They really just need the margin to do it. They really just need a permission. That's what I believe that as I've seen it. And in a way, the dojo is kind of a way to enable that permission to kind of allow what feels unnatural in terms of giving teams space to learn and grow. It allows them to put a structure and a name to, we're going to let these people go on a retreat to learn how to be awesome and master their skills.
And we keep going back through to teams, and it's not just 10 developers, right? There's a product owner. There's a whole it's basically a self-contained unit in an org, right? So it's not like someone is being left behind. It's you really trying to coalesce as a team, you know, develop that autonomy, that killer instinct, right, to get the work done, like, because it's slow down and speed up. But it's not just developers. I'm assuming there's product owners in the whole kit and caboodle, right? If you're on the team, you're in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always been about building a cross-functional team. And as you might imagine, I mean, the developers are often the ones that are left there or assumed to be the ones that would spend the 6 hours a day. And we have to remind them that no, everybody needs the scrum master, the product owner need to be there 6 hours a day. And then, you know, it gives an opportunity to start thinking differently because product owners are, you know, you give people a certain amount of time, hours a day to be part of X, they're going to find work that matches the time they have available. So if you have a product owner, for example, and this is just one of the ways it could play out, a product owner really is going to go to 6 hours a day with everyone else. They're going to learn new skills. They're going to learn maybe things like BDD. They're going to learn how to say given when thens and commit code, you know,
or how to pair with developers.
You're right. Exactly. How to pair, how to teach them things. So we really, one of the big things is T-shaping. So I'm personally a generalist, and I know that I'd love everybody in the world to be a generalist. So I know that I can't just impose that upon the world, but at the same time, I believe that there needs to be more generalism. I can stand behind that. I've seen the power. There's power in having people really, really cross-train each other and respect each other's skill sets, not only vertically, but also to teach each other some of the basics. There's value in that on just the obvious level, but also if you know that what you learn and what you're good at has to be transferred to someone less inclined, you're going to it's kind of like TDD. It's kind of like you're going to encapsulate the way you do in a way that's more translatable. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. So most of my career, Drew, has been spent coaching product people, and I feel like in some ways, I don't teach the exact same things that you do, but the same mentality of, hey, if you sit down and like talk with a developer or a tech lead or a tester, like while like if you I teach user story kickoff sessions where you kind of go through like everybody all together kind of sitting there going, if we do this, like we're all agreement and that this will accomplish our goals, right? Like yeah. that type of pairing mentality is how I teach business folks who don't know how to code their way out of a wet paper bag to actually like hold their own in a technical conversation and say, hey, it's actually a good thing to learn how to speak like their language and know how they view their work and see their work differently. And that's how you get better requirements and user stories. Yeah. And you know, like it's, I love that mentality because we should be doing it more. We should be pairing more. Like we should care, the business folks, we should care about what our developers are doing and how they test, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And how they approach problems and all that. So yeah, yeah. It's really neat to see that play out. So we had a really interesting product owner come in and she was just used to spend all her time with other, you know, areas, which is what you're supposed to do. It's all good. And it's good to know that everybody has to sit in all those other meetings, you know, so it's great that I get the whole specialization, but she was just so moved by just being able to spend that much time with the team and learn about what they're facing. You know, it changed the whole way she related to them and the way that she got used. And she was able to take the extra time that she had and spend way more time on getting user feedback that it just closed these open circuits close these open circuits in really tight ways that everyone had a better sense of who they're building for. I've seen it over and over.
So I have a question for you. And this might be, this is a little bit left of what we were just talking about. So we talk about bringing these teams in and we talk about, okay, you're in here for 6 weeks, you're doing 2.5 day sprints, you're bringing your backlog. We're going to create this working agreement, a community map. We're going to get going. Now, is there also, and you said it yourself, you're a generalist, and we all know that some of the technology folks, especially now, which the speed that software development is at delivery is working at, you go way down the rabbit hole, the nerd hole, I call it, real quickly. Is there also a space, Drew, where you can do, like, have a technical coach brought in who's just like, say I need just a Docker guy, or say I need someone who really knows CI/CD and can help walk us through that. And you can't be, obviously you can't be expected to know everything. As bright as you are, you can't know everything. Does that also play into how you structure your dojo and how the internal ceremonies work for that 6 weeks, how the practices are absorbed?
Yeah. There's many times in the dojo I was able to coach the team without any additional, you know, paired coaching, where other teams, especially the cloud migration teams and some of the DevOps, it would be two of us that were with the team the whole time. Generally, I would be high touch the first 2 weeks and then I'd go medium touch and low touch the last, because we were getting them to do their own, you know, more of their own ceremonies and all that kind of agile stuff, as you'd expect, where the technical coach is kind of, their touch is a little more constant. To help them, you know, debug things and get through the stuff. And, you know, every company is going to have not just the skills, but also how to navigate through the organizational issues on getting security things worked out and all that. Right. So the tech coaches were much more constant with teams. It just depended on the team. So a lot of teams, I was fine doing it myself. That's really where it's free. We found, and I was kind of pushing for this more than to say, I can coach the team, but I need to know that I can bring in other technical specialists in for special sessions or whatever, or for certain short sprints to get something done. So I like the playing kind of a triangle offense. We would call it. It's kind of ways we put it at my last gig.
meaning an offense that it takes years to learn correctly, and that only one coach can coach it correctly. And
no.
I, yeah. as the basketball nerd in the room, I would like to point out that the triangle offense is way outdated, and we should not use this. It's pace and space. It's pace and space, gang.
Okay, like okay, Mervin. As Tex Winter knocks on your door,
yeah.
So you see Steve.
Yeah,
seeing Steve Kerr took it to another level, basically.
Exactly. Tex Winter died early this year, for the record, Jay. So thanks for pissing on his grave. There's two super nerds out there that absolutely heard what I said and they're like, thank you, Merm. Thank you.
hopefully they're listening. Along that line, Drew, right? So we talked about the need for the technical piece of it. Is it possible to do this type of activity, this type of dojo with a non-technical, like a non-delivery team? Have you seen that done? Is it even a crazy idea?
I think Merm was the one who was pissing on Tex when his grace.
Maybe.
I'm still not. I'm not over that yet.
I'm a Lakers fan, so he helped win a bunch of titles for my team. So I can't denigrate him too much. All right, Jay's shaking his head. We got him. Yeah. We got to move.
Okay. Okay. But no, I do want to say you should read Phil Jackson's book, 11 Rings. Totally a great book on coaching. Read that book. Enjoy this last 45 seconds of banter, whoever you are out there.
He completely shit on Kobe in that book, and I like his previous coaching book better. But that this is a type of nerdism that this group does not need.
Yeah,
Drew, you and I clearly have shit to talk about. Often, right? Like that's what we've learned.
All right, we've learned that. All right, Phil Jackson. Okay, and so Jay said.
Not non-technical. Can we do a non-technical dojo? Yeah. Can we do it for a non-delivery dojo? Yes. Is that possible?
Yes. Sure. Sure. I mean, the general concepts are there where you have work to do and you want to be able to have focus and you want to be able to have some, you know, great people with great life experience teach you and help you focus on that and get some, you know, some good work. We actually had a lot of work around. Well, let me frame it this way. The dojo allows you to think differently about doing things that may have been outside of your area. So like things like forming product teams. So product thinking, product teams is a way for an organization to also reinvent how they organize their teams. So you have less of an outside inside kind of product thing, but you really have end to end. You really say from concept to not only deployment, even support and feedback and back to the whole cycles within this space of one team. So as we started to see this work out and saw that it was possible and improved it, we had dojos, or at least shorter term ones, maybe long workshops you could even call them, around just helping organizations rethink how to organize teams, how to reinvent your understanding of who contributes to business value. So you can definitely apply the dojo concept with more than just delivering software.
Cool. Go on, Mervin.
Yeah. So I think that we've done our, especially you, Drew, because it's Jay and I are just asking the dumbass questions. But I think that you have illuminated a lot about the dojo. I'm curious, like, what do you, now that the term is kind of getting around a little bit, what do you feel like people have wrong? Like, what kind of myths do you feel like need to be debunked about the dojo in general?
You never want to think of it as a baby behavior repair play. That's the first thing.
As send us your tired, your broken-hearted developers, and we will fix them.
You don't do it as we're going to apply this to the teams that are struggling the most.
The huddled masses of coders.
Yeah, right. you got to be kind of more blue ocean about the way you think about how to apply it. I found it best when teams could be made aware of it and could seek and find. And the teams that did the best in the dojo are the ones that had a certain amount of ability to kind of to ask for it and request it and have it granted versus have it assigned to them. Just like a lot of things, you know. I mean, it really is a place where you're going to, like, you know, the big motivators in people are, you know, autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So you're going to get all that. The dojo is going to help enhance that. But if those things are only being talked about or just done in name only, then you're going to have struggles. So that goes down one of the channels. Apart from that, man, I guess, you know, the other thing is that if you misunderstand the cost, I think you're going to have a problem. So I mentioned before about training. So companies are really easy for them to rationalize training as it's an investment in our people. They go away from their work, they come back, they get more done, but the cost is really high. So it's important to think of the dojo in a different kind of cost model. Since they're going to be doing the same work they're doing anyway, you really can rationalize it as being cheaper than you might otherwise think. I think that's an important thing that's under considered in the equation.
That's a good point, because if I'm bringing my body of work, and like you said, I'm bringing a sticky wicket. I'm bringing something where the team maybe is a little too far wrapped around the axle, right, and not being able to make forward progress. It's actually cheaper than sending them away to a training course, because while they're and I'm doing gratuitous air quotes here, while they're training, while they're learning, they're also doing the work. They're doing constructive work along with it.
Yeah, they're going to deliver work and they're going to learn some lean aspects of creating knowledge assets are going to be assets for other people to go back following their trail. Hopefully. I mean, if they're, you know, it depends on what they focus on.
So what are the type of pitfalls, Drew, you want to watch out for? So like where have you seen, or where have you, in speaking to your other network of dojo coaches, where have you seen teams start to go south, start to go left where they should have gone right? What do you look for, and then how do you correct it?
Oh, one of the big ones is something you might otherwise encounter anyway. It isn't too much that's completely unique, I would say, but the big one is you have a team that's committed to come in to be coached and to be given leeway to get it done. But then you set it up so, hey, stakeholder, we're doing demos twice a week. Come in at the demo, you'll get all the updates you need, yay. And then this part of the equation that we put in as coaches to say, this is going to be so great for the team, and I can have constant, you know, updates to their management. They only have to talk to them twice a week. So you set up a whole equation and you're so happy about it. But then you hear like a week or two down the line that the management's calling them on the side after hours all around the edges of it and demanding all these reports and things. So then people get burnt out and you don't even know why until you're like halfway through it. So that's one of the big ones. So just so what we've done to mitigate that is where we basically have a weekly call with the manager to help them, you know, to help them understand what's going on and see if there's things that they need or they're not seeing that that they're expecting, you know, whatever they're expecting that we didn't promise, you know, along the way are mitigating factors that they care about. And we also sometimes use it as a chance to coach them if we're interested in ways to think about product teams and product thinking and even business values. Like a few of the management teams have said, hey, why don't we read this book? Why don't we join the book club? Art of Business Value, Mark Schwartz. Be great for you to hang out with us around that book, which is one of my favorite books.
It's like in a way, you're kind of teaching stakeholders about the pain points of interruptions, like in a dojo in a very rapid format. Because, I mean, let me tell you, and you have to have felt this, I mean, all three of us have to have felt this before, is there's nothing like you have a planning session, regardless of how big or small your planning session is. We say, let's do this. And then as soon as the developer goes off on their own, their dev manager comes up and says, hey, I know they said work on this, but actually you work on this instead. And by the way, right, I'm your actual boss, so go work on this shit, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
it happens. It's not all the time, but yeah, it's just so keeping in touch with the leadership's important and all that. So, yeah, I mean, there's always been a mixed bag. Everything, there's never a pure success in each one. So there's always some kind of matter mixed bag with them.
So let me ask a sort of a weird question, Drew. We talk about 6 hours a day and you get the whole team there and they're all, you know, they're in it to win it. And we talked about all the benefits of a product owner who's sitting there spending 6 hours a day. Maybe he picks up behavior-driven development, right? Given when thens and all that. Eventually, ideally, you get him working in Cucumber. Is it possible to do this sort of activity? And I know this is, it's probably going to set your hackles up, but is it possible to do this sort of activity remotely? Has anybody tried it? Is there any experience with it? I mean, it doesn't seem that it would easily translate, but somebody somewhere is going to try it, because the reality is distributed teams and software delivery are just, it just, whether we like it or not, it's here to stay. So is that something that's been discussed, bandied, attempted? That's
exactly the sticky wicket I'm trying to solve right now. It's been wild. I mean, at Verizon, we had this mandate, they must all be local, but then of course, who is? So we dealt with mixed location teams right from the beginning. There was never a team that was, well, there was rarely a team that was purely co-located. So we would have people on bridges and you deal with all the standard stuff you deal with. We had our facilities were poorly designed for, you know, multiple bridge play, you know, right, and have that work. So I was pushing for that early on, that we have teams, you know, in more of an enclosed space so they can stay on the bridge better. It's really a tough deal. In my current gig, we're actually going with this idea that they're either all together or all remote, because there's that dynamic when you're all remote, then you're all on equal playing ground in terms of listening well and all that kind of thing. So now to really make it work remotely, I don't think there's any real there's no deal breakers on remote, but we have to really think about some of our collaboration tools, which is something we should probably think more about anyway. Honestly, I don't see a lot of organizations having that. Well, I think we can be further down the path. So like certain tools like Cardboard and things like that, that allow you to get around a whiteboard together and everybody move stickies around, you know, prioritize things in a visual way. But I think if you do that, you can succeed with a virtual dojo. So we're doing that currently. We're setting those up. One of the good examples is that one or two of the teams we had at Verizon was had an offshore component. So we had to work out a deal. It's like, okay, the people offshore are going to have to work weird hours or we are. And we worked at some kind of middle ground, and that worked well. Whereas the teams where we'd say, oh, well, we'll have a 2-hour overlap. You know, you'll be 4 hours alone and 2 hours with us, and same here on the onshore side. And that just got harder. It was a lot easier to have things kind of blow up and combinatorial weirdness go on. So having a core hours together it seems to be the main thing. Not 100%, but at least probably over 50% core hours, I think, is pretty much a safe way to keep the integrity of it.
And I'll be honest. I mean, one of the transformations I've worked on in my career, everybody was co-located. It was almost like a rare, I guess I've learned it's become a rarity that everyone was in the same building, and it actually made it easier. And some of the stuff I worked on later after that fact, teams are heavily distributed, people in different time zones, different parts of the country, different parts of the planet. So it's been, I do see the benefit of, well, you need to, teams need to learn to work well together when they're not all in the same room, because that is, not to say it's perfect, but it's the new normal, right? So I'm excited to hear that there is some chance there. I'm also a big proponent of the idea of if one person's remote, everybody's remote. I think that's a powerful way to go about things. And I'm glad to hear that's an idea. Yeah.
And just another technique around that too is we're used to having meetings be meetings. So when we're on a WebEx, we think of it as a meeting. We think that we're not getting work. There's a lot of things that go into our assumptions about time on a bridge, right? We're not going to get work done. We're going to talk. We're probably going to spin. You know, we're going to make decisions that only half of us are clear on. You know, there's a lot of things about meetings that are just so like dysfunctionally normal, if I could be that rude. The idea is when we have to basically tell people we're going to be in a bridge all day. We're going to be on a bridge for 6 hours, and then we would just have to redefine it. We're not always going to be deciding. We're just going to work. It's like a working session with an occasional stand up. Like all the ceremonies you do in Scrum are ancillary to the bridge time rather than the whole reason you're on a bridge. So it's actually pretty liberating when you start to do it, because the ceremonies and Scrum are supposed to be ancillary to your working together, not the only time you work together. And often, I'll bet it's happening where you work too, people out there, that's become, you have it upside down. And the dojo is one, if nothing else, if one of many reasons you'd like it, is it helps really break up that fallacy.
I'd just like to point out that we're 40-something, 50 minutes into this podcast, and the true reason for Jay's need to do this podcast comes out, which is how do I come up with a technique to get my distributed teams to code faster? Like now we've like we've truly.
I resemble that remark.
So the reason why all of Jay's podcasts go to distributed teams is because he's like, hey, how do I get my distributed teams to
I'm trying to get all of you to solve all my problems. Yeah.
Drew, I'm so sorry that you're part of this nefarious plot.
What else can I help you with, Jay?
Yeah. Here's also how he can get stakeholders to get behind his distributed teams format, right?
Because if there's an agile hill I'm going to die on, it's going to be that remote and distributed teams are the norm, not the exception, and we need to get good at dealing with them in every way possible. And if there are, it's a lot like It's not like when you go through some personal coaching or you have an Agile coach work with you, you know, there's things you do well and there's things you don't. And if you really concentrate on the things you do well, you can almost make up for the things you don't. I think it's one of those things we just need to get, we need to get good at it. That's just my
I'd like to point out that the new Pope just explained to us recently that there is no such thing as a hell. So like, so I don't think you're going to Agile hell. I just think you're going to another strange place in the Agile universe. I don't think it's going to be pretty, but it's, at least it won't be hell. Right?
So I know we're coming up on time, so we'll wrap it up, but I will say this. If there is an Agile hell, I think we could spend an entire episode talking about
what
that would be. Post-its where the post-its don't stick.
That's the follow-up to our April Fool's fragile manifesto thing that we did last year.
What is Agile hell? And I would say that Agile hell? If there is an actual hell, I think it is personalized, because for me, I would be almost like Sisyphus, except I would be in a giant cat litter box, scooping cat litter for all eternity. And the only thing I'd be able to hear would be Dave Matthews Band on repeat.
So this coming from the dude that's been shoveling cats out of his lap the entire podcast through. There's like seven inside jokes that you just have to do. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Well, guys, I'm gonna take this one home. So I'm gonna go around the horn. Merman, final thoughts, anything you want to shout out, anything?
For all the business folks and leaders in the room, like, please hear this podcast as an invitation. Please sit with your developers. Please spend time with them. Please find opportunity to pair with them. I think that Drew's approach is great, not just for the technical folks that are trying to improve the way they work, but just overall, like our overall team health. Like, please find a developer and hug him or her and just pair with them, right? Just do it. It'll do your body good, or your backlog, one of the two.
It'll do your backlog good. There's an advertising campaign in there that
we need to
copyright quickly. Drew,
pairing.
Final thoughts.
Wow. I want to say that it's just an honor to be on a podcast that has been touched and graced by all the different authors of Agile. I'm a big fan of all those that have really liberated people to be masters at their level of engineering. So it's just really great to be just in the general orbit of that, the whole scene on this podcast. That's basically all I got.
Awesome. Well, on behalf of, let me say my final thought. I usually don't end with anything Agile related. All I will throw out there is, as Merman starts snickering, is the band Hate Eternal just put out a new album, Upon Desolate Sands. It is quickly in my top 10 metal albums of the year. So check that one out. And there we go. So on behalf of Chris and myself and the rest of the Agile Uprising, Drew, I'd like to thank you very, very much for your time. Hopefully we can have you on again. On behalf of Drew, myself, and Chris, I want to thank all of our listeners. Once again, check us out. If you want to be involved in the conversation, go to coalition.agileuprising.com. If you like what you hear, maybe you're a new listener, it's a good time as any to subscribe if you want. Leave us a review on iTunes. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. And we look forward to many more conversations. So on behalf of everyone, thank you very much. And enjoy your evening. Oh, wait. Drew, final shout-out?
Yes, I got to give a big shout-out to Dojo and Company, dojoandco.com. Joel Tosi and Dion Stewart are the guys that really showed me what's up. And if you ever get a chance to run into them, they'll take it to the next level. So I hope that happens for everybody out there.
Awesome. Thank you, Drew. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy your evening, and until next time.